You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Live from a bunker in the heart of the Ozarks. The best thing about this podcast is it hasn't happened yet. It's SifPop. Welcome to SifPop Weekly, streaming live. Most Fridays are available to download later in your podcast feed. Unless, of course, you're a patron.
Patrons get perks.
Patrons get those perks.
Woo!
I'm your host, Aaron Dicer, and he was in the Amazon with your mom researching spiders. It's Andrew Ormsby, ladies and gentlemen. Each week we will chat about movies, TV, and whatever else from the pop culture universe is on our minds. And please welcome our guest this week. She's not here to peddle her wares. Thank you very much. It's Courtney Lanning.
Hey!
I also steal ambulances.
Okay, fair enough. Good to know. Good to know. Do those ambulances go at full speed towards the end of a dock for some reason? Sorry, I'm already into the review. It was a weird overhead shot. That we will get to eventually. We are going to talk about Madam Web today. We are going to talk about Drive Away Dolls as well. Ethan Coen's first movie away from Joel. I don't think Ian's directed anything without Joel.
Second,
Courtney's gonna figure this out and make sure that we are correct. But whatever
we
the
have
case,
the technology.
We do. Things that should have been researched by me beforehand. We're also gonna do a best ever challenge, Dakota Johnson movies, and of course our buried treasure as well. Before we get into it, a quick reminder: the Spaskers are coming soon. We will once again be doing a live show during the Oscars, talking about the different awards and keeping track of who has made the best picks until we get to a winner at the end of the night. So if you want to be involved, if you want to have fun with us, put your picks up against ours, see how well you can do, then you just need to go to siftpop.com. That's SIFTPOP.com and click on where it says Spaskers. And you can make your picks, get them in, and then tune in on Oscars night to see how you do with the rest of the SifPop crew. So looking forward to that. How are you guys feeling about the Oscars? Are we getting excited for it? Is there anything you care about this year? Like, Courtney, I haven't really talked to you about award season that much. How are you feeling?
You know, the number one thing that is always going to be on my mind front and center at the Oscars, what everybody truly cares about, best animated feature.
I'm sensing a big push for Nimona your world.
Probably Nimona. Could be Spider-Verse. I'd also be very happy with The Boy and the Heron. I'm just thrilled that Wish didn't even make the cut.
As it shouldn't have. Wish may be one of the most terrible Disney movies ever made. I don't understand that movie. It's so, I say it's the most terrible, but it's only the most terrible just because it's so, what do the kids say, mid? It's so mid. Like, there's nothing about it that's interesting or thought through or, yeah, I'm glad it wasn't nominated as well.
Anytime you find a way to suck the life out of Chris Pine, you know you've created an abomination.
Yes. Yes, that is true. What about you, Andrew?
I have not seen Wish. No. Every single year when it comes to the Oscars, I get this sense that all my picks are going to be garbage. But somehow every single year, you know, I somehow manage to pull it through. But again, this year, especially when it comes to Best Actor, I think that one is just up in the air for me. Normally, I'm fairly decent with picks, but it's between Paul Giamatti and Bradley Cooper. It's between those two for me.
Yeah. I'm going to pick Anthony Hopkins to come in at the last second and somehow win it, even though he wasn't nominated. That's my official Oscars pick. That's what I see happening.
Too late. That's on paper now. You can't change that.
I'm excited whatever happens. I'm excited to watch it with you guys. I'm excited to hang out again. It's been really fun. We have been live for some of the most interesting television moments in history, including an Oscar ceremony. Yeah, that slapped for sure. So you can see our reactions to the slap live as they happen, if you go back and watch that video. And that's kind of part of the fun of doing this live is like you see us go through the same thing that everybody went through. Like, is this staged? Is it real? Yeah. What's going? No, he really seems angry. No, they're yelling at each other. They're upset. How is Chris Rock keeping his composure? How is Will Smith still in the building? Like all of these things, as we are going through it live.
How awkward is it going to be when he wins?
Yes. The answer, very awkward. That is the answer.
Awkward.
You never know what's going to happen at the Oscars, but what you do know is we're going to be there watching it live with you. So come hang out with us and do that. It's the weekend of like March 12th, I think. Is that the Sunday that it's on? It's somewhere on that weekend. Excited to hang out with you guys and watch that. All right, we got some movies to review, so let's go ahead and get into it. Let's start by chatting about Madam Web.
A week ago, I spent my life racing against time.
I'm gonna help you out today, okay?
Trying to save people who were running out of it.
Getty!
Until one moment changed everything.
Come on!
Welcome back to the land that we're living.
I don't understand what's happening. I've been having visions. I knew he was gonna die. I think I'm seeing the future.
Madam Web tells the standalone origin story of one of Marvel Publishing's most enigmatic heroines. The suspense-driven thriller stars Dakota Johnson as Cassandra Webb, a paramedic in Manhattan who develops the power to see the future and realizes she can use that insight to change it. Forced to confront revelations about her past, she forges a relationship with three young women bound for powerful destinies if they can all survive a deadly present. Sony continues to throw Spider-Verse spaghetti at the wall and try to see what sticks. And the question is, does anything here stick? What did you guys think? Did you like it, love it, dislike it, hate it, or it was just okay? Andrew, your thoughts?
They must have slacked that wall with Crisco because nothing's sticking here. I'm hating this movie, man.
Andrew hates it. Courtney, do you like it, love it, dislike it, hate it, or it was just okay?
It was okay. So bad it's good. I also really, really like Adam Scott. So
you managed to have a good time.
I did.
I'm somewhere in between the two of you. I'm going to go on high side of didn't like it. So that's where I'm going to land up. Like just teetering into it was okay where you're at, Courtney. But I'm going to land in didn't like it because it's an abomination. But Courtney, you liked it more than us. So speak on the joys of watching Dakota Johnson and Madam Web.
So I think I'm in a very small camp. I have found some way to enjoy all of Sony's little Spider-Man adjacent movies. I like the buddy slash romance of Eddie and Venom and Venom 2. I liked Morbius. I thought it was very campy fun. And Madam Web, to me, I found a way to enjoy it. It was so bad it was good. You know, it's not a good movie. I'm not saying it's a good movie. I still had fun watching it.
Yeah. Just help me out because I didn't have fun. What specifically made it fun for you? Like what parts of it really worked for you that made it a fun experience? Or was it just like, this is terrible. This is ridiculous. I'm laughing at how in the world this got made. Like, is it that kind of so bad it's good? Or was there actual stuff you were like, oh, no, this is fun?
No, I think it is mostly so bad it's good for me. But I think I'm so worn out on a lot of Marvel's latest stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm worn out on whatever it is DC has tried doing over the last year or two. that these Sony movies that are a throwback to the early 2000s, you know, comic book movies where the effects don't look good, the writing doesn't make any sense, it's very cheesy.
The main villain speaks in only ADR.
ADR.
Hey, right. Don't steal my jokes, Aaron. Don't steal my jokes.
All of that together, I guess I find it kind of refreshing. You know, if I'm looking at Marvel offering up Secret Invasion and Quantumania, and I'm looking at Sony offering up Morbius and Madame Web, I'd watch Morbius and Madame Web three more times before I watch Quantumania once, because that throwback to the early 2000s, we know it's going to be bad, but we're going to have a good time anyway. And again, I really do like Adam Scott, and I feel like, you know, he comes in, he does his Parks and Rec bit as, do we want to spoil whoever he's playing?
No, we don't. Okay. But it's wild how this movie tries to connect itself. Yeah,
it does. And I feel like, you know, in Dakota Johnson's defense, she does the best she can with what she's given. She's not given a lot, but I feel like, you know, she tries to bring some charismatic performances here, despite being swallowed up by a tsunami of mid writing, as the kids say.
I remain unconvinced, but I will say that I think I understand what you're saying with So Bad It's Good, in that I went into this movie with such low expectations. Word on the street, I don't watch anything, but it had even gotten through to me that this was a terrible movie before I even went in to watch it. And so I went in just going, oh, this is going to be, you know, terrible. And so with my lowered expectations, it's a lot less annoying. When you go in with lowered expectations, I think you're a lot less annoyed at things, or at least I am personally, because like, oh yeah, I knew this was going to be, you know, ridiculous and terrible. And it allowed me to see some things in the movie that I may not have seen if my eyes were rolled back in my head so far that I couldn't, you know, see them. So one of those being for me is, I think this movie has the bones of an interesting tale. Like there's an interesting thing this movie could have done with ideas of like maternal love that it thinks it's doing, like that it's trying to do. Like that theme is draped over this movie in a very real way, but because of the poor writing and the clunky plotting and the clear way this movie has been chopped to pieces and put together to be something it, you know, clearly wasn't originally intended to be, in my opinion, that it doesn't quite work. But that idea of this character as a mom to these three, and the mother-daughter stuff that she deals with, that she comes to peace with and figures out what maternal sacrifice looked like in her life, like all that stuff is interesting to play in. Like we all know 9 out of every 10 movies is about fathers and sons because dudes direct 9 out of every 10 movies. And it's nice to kind of see a movie about mothers and daughters. And, you know, there are plenty of movies about mothers and daughters, but it would be nice to see a big budget superhero movie that was talking about those things. This just isn't the movie to make it really work. But I was at least engaged by some of the stuff that was going on there with, you know, the mothering, the mother aspect of it all. So, so yeah. Andrew, did you have anything you wanted to say positive, on the positive end of this movie you hate?
No, I don't. I honestly don't have any positives for it. So,
you don't think Dakota Johnson was at least somewhat entertaining?
Not at all. She's one of my least favorite parts about the movie. I know that was a joke, but honestly, you know what? I will say this. She was not the worst part of the movie for me. I think Tahar Rahim really disappointed me. Really,
yeah, disappointed me. Talk about it.
Like you mentioned, Tahar Rahim, he takes the cake in my utter disappointment with what I can only assume was a performance so bad they had ADR almost all of his lines. I have no idea what
it's either that's so bad, or the movie got changed so much that the character had to be completely different, and so they had to like change all the dialogue. My understanding is that originally this was supposed to be in the 90s, and then they moved it to the early 2000s. By the way, both movies today, early 2000s, Girls Road Trips. Like, this is like, you know, yeah. theme day. It's SIFF pop. These movies are identical is what I'm saying.
let's not go that far, Aaron.
This is what happens when girls go on road trips. Terrible things happen.
That's right. I'll let you continue with other things about the main villain that you know, we're off putting to you, but I feel like something had to change in the plot that changed every single thing about that character, because it was terrible. It was like watching a bad dub at times. Like, it was really bad.
Yeah. It was really bad.
Go ahead.
No, I was done. I was just saying it was really bad.
I think, and this is a very out there connection, but it's in the web. I think what sort of laid the groundwork for this movie and how corny it was going to be for me was Next with Nicolas Cage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This movie, I mean, that movie already seems like a great value version of a movie. This seems like a great value version of a great value version of a movie. But that ability to see a couple seconds into the future, tweak a couple things around.
Or a few minutes into the future, depending on what the scene needs. Yeah. They played that trailer before the movie when I went and saw it, by the way. The Next trailer, the Nick Cage movie, that was one of the trailers before Madam Web at the Alamo. So they always do fun stuff like that. Just so for somebody in our chat and maybe anybody who's listening who had the same question, ADR is automated dialogue replacement. It is basically what movies do when they're taking the dialogue that was said on set into the boom mics or the microphones there and changing it and having somebody come in afterwards and try to record and match it up with, you know, what they're doing, try to match up their lips in the movie, or in this case, just take the shots from behind them so they don't have to worry about the lips. So yeah, that's what ADR is.
Yeah. Beyond the ADR though, I had a lot of problems with, the Tahar Rahim character. I could get behind the premise of what drives him. From a villain standpoint, I know that these three girls are going to come after me one day. I got to kill them now. It's very Terminator. I can get behind it, you know. But the character design and the way that the characters performed, the writing around it, nothing about it works. Especially the character design. Like, what are you even trying to? You're trying so hard not to say the word Spider-Man that you're getting Spider-Man all over this non-Spider-Man movie.
But the movie barely Spider-Mans. Like there's barely any Spider-Man going on. Like,
that's,
you know,
that's
what
a
I
good
mean?
Verb. I like that verb. It's Spider-Mans.
Spider-Persons. Like there's one final set piece, and there's a piece at the diner and a piece in traffic. The piece in the diner and the piece in traffic, nothing really happens except for just a little, you know, see the future ex machina kind of stuff. Like, that's all that really happens. There's not a lot of action in this action superhero movie. So yeah, it's really interesting that it is supposed to be in the Spider-Man universe when there's just not a lot of Spider-Maning going on around. So, yeah. Other thoughts?
If you take the firework to the face, it'll paralyze you.
Yes, that is what happens.
I did get a kick out of the fact that they didn't even bother putting in an after credits clip. Morbius made a big deal about, oh, we've got the Vulture in this universe now. And with this one, they were just like, look, we know you probably didn't even stay till the credits. There's no way. There's nothing we can stick after here. So we're not even going to bother.
Yeah.
Even Aquaman 2 had an after credits, and you know that universe was being destroyed.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't have a lot of fun tearing down movies. So I don't want to keep like going on about how terrible this movie is. But Andrew, that's what you're here for. So
okay. I was getting a little sense of camaraderie, like, yeah, I don't want to sit here tearing down a movie, but no, okay, let's turn this whole 180. I can tear down a movie if you want me to. No, I can't tear down a movie without getting into spoilers, because a lot of my issues with this movie are like minute details of things that just don't add up. But I can't get into them without, you know, getting into spoilers and stuff. I will say that the product placement for Pepsi in this is absolutely atrociously bad.
I mean, it's Power Rangers Krispy Kreme bad, isn't it? Like,
it's really bad.
It's terrible.
Okay, yeah. But let's compare that to a movie like Sonic the Hedgehog, which has Olive Garden in place of the Pepsi sponsorship. Mm-hmm.
Also bad.
Okay, yeah. But the fact that Sonic was a better movie, we overlook the sponsorship, or?
No, we do not.
Oh, okay. I wanted a clear sense of the rules here at Sift Pop.
No, it could be Lord of the Rings, and if Lord of the Rings was hawking, Xbox controllers, we would still give it everything else look good about Lord of the Rings.
That would be a different movie.
It would be a very different movie.
I guess I figured with a brand like Sift Pop, you were going to give a little break to the pop in the sponsorship for this movie.
No.
And that didn't happen.
No. The only break I would ever give to product placement is the self-aware, you know, hold the Pizza
Hut
box and Pizza Hut up kind of thing. And honestly, after Wayne's World did it, I kind of don't even give grace for that anymore, because it's been done. And it's like, you know, yeah, I get that joke. I've seen that joke before. I like that a little bit more than just this absolute shoehorning of brands that is, you know, happening in a lot of movies. But then there's the other side of me that's like, yeah, but I kind of want to keep seeing movies. So make your money how you can make your money. Like, you know,
they can make their movie however they want to, but they got to stop making $100 million or $200-300 million movies.
Yeah.
You don't need that much money to make a movie. Then you don't have to rely on sponsorships like that anymore.
Yeah. Do we listen? It's not happening. I mean, it would be a crazy world if it happened. But do we want any way to see a sequel from this movie? Like, would we be? Is there any way to save this concept in your guys' mind?
Let me say this real quick. There's a lot of false marketing with this movie, because this movie markets. There's been a lot of false marketing with movies lately. And it's driving me insane. It really is.
Well, I would argue that the history of movies has been mostly false marketing.
But don't you see that it's getting out of hand? Like, I think of Argyle, or how they're not marketing movies properly, like with Mean Girls, The Color Purple. What was the other one that was a musical? Wonka. That they're just not marketing.
Wonka.
Thank you. Yeah, they're not marketing these movies properly. And in this one, they market the three young girls as already being superheroes. Like, that's what.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah. It shows them in their outfits and stuff. So you think it's going to be this team up superhero film, but it's not. It's very much Terminator, and it's very bad Terminator.
Yeah.
Well, see, but you weren't going to win on the superhero aspect, because when the trailer came out and they did have these girls in their costumes, the number one thing I kept seeing in online discourse is, great, they found a way to make the CW shows look good. So even if they had put these characters in here in these costumes, even if they had given them some superpowered fights, you were going to have people complaining about the fact that they looked terrible, that the costumes weren't right, et cetera, et cetera. So whether you put the costumes in there, whether you leave them out, I don't think there's a winning path to go down when it comes to that particular element of the movie.
I know a winning path. Make a great costume. That's a winning path. Like, it doesn't have to be like lowest common denominator kind of superhero stuff. Like, you can actually, you know, design cool stuff. But I think the point that Andrew is making, if I may hijack it a little bit, is one that I would also agree with, is that there is something interesting about this female superhero team that the marketing promises. I didn't know the marketing promised it, but even in just watching the movie, there's something interesting there that the movie is just not interested in. This movie is just not interested in them as a superhero team. It's interested in them as surrogate daughters for Dakota Johnson, and you know, that's, you know, I don't know. I don't find that as interesting, at least in the way it was delivered through this movie. But a sequel, I don't know. I think there's something interesting here. Although what we're presented with of who Madame Web is at the end is so different than anything we've seen up till like 5 seconds before the end that, you know, like I'm just going, is that from the sequel? Like, what are we watching here? Like it kind of made no sense, to me what they showed at the end. Like I couldn't figure it out.
Now you're not alone.
Do I want a sequel to everything we've talked about? No. Do I want a sequel to the last 5 seconds? I might be open to that.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
I wouldn't have any issue if, you know, we had a sequel where the, you know, the three girls get their powers through some sort of spider-related incidents, where we see Adam Scott's character come into his own in a further story, where we see the Madame Web, who's already in her chair and has a pretty good sense of what time travel looks like for her. Yeah, I'd be totally open with that. But you could also make the argument that that's what this movie should have been in the first place.
Yeah. I got to be honest, I'll take Birds of Prey sequel long before I take a sequel to this. I think Birds of Prey does a lot of what this movie is trying to do so much better. And I'd say watch that instead of this. That'd be my final thing. You guys have any one last thing you want to share?
It's already been mentioned, but no post-credit scene.
It's true.
Thankfully.
Anything else, Courtney?
I guess we'll see how Kraven the Hunter does.
I feel
like when it comes to these Sony Spider-Man adjacent movies, you can basically put them in two camps. People seem to like Venom 1 and 2 for the most part, for what they are. People didn't seem to enjoy Morbius or Madame Web, so you're split right down the middle. We'll see where Kraven lands.
All right. There you go. That is Madame Web. I don't think you need to check it out, but maybe just to have a good laugh. Maybe Courtney's right. Maybe there's something about just going and being a part of it, and you'll enjoy it even though you know it's ridiculous. So
it's also like whenever you're driving by a car wreck, you know, you can't help but watch, you know. It's one of those things. So maybe you want to self-masochist and you just want to torture yourself for an hour and a half.
If I'm driving by a car wreck, I'm trying not to be involved in the wreck. Now, if I'm driving by the results of a car wreck, then yeah, I may rubberneck a little bit, but that's a little little semantic distinction. But yeah,
I mean, fair enough. You could basically say this is going to be on Netflix here because I'm pretty sure Sony has a distribution deal with Netflix. This will be on Netflix in what? 60, 90 days. If you really want to watch it, that's the place to do it. 90 minutes.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. All right, let's move on to our next review. Let's talk a little bit about Drive Away Dolls.
Hello, girls. It's the last body shot competition, so we are going to salt you up.
I've had it with love. I don't believe it's relevant to the 21st century lesbian.
You're not wearing that.
I just came from work.
I came from Toledo. I don't dress like it.
I'm not here to peddle my wares. What? I'm leaving town.
I am too. That was my plan. Where are you going?
Tallahassee, Florida. I've been unhappy.
That's why we take this trip together, honey babe.
We get our act together, together.
Written by Ethan Coen and Trisha Cook, this comedy caper follows Jamie, an uninhibited free spirit, bemoaning yet another breakup with a girlfriend, and her demure friend Marion, who desperately needs to loosen up. Well, that's one way to put it. In search of a fresh start, the two embark on an impromptu road trip to Tallahassee, but things quickly go awry when they cross paths with a group of inept criminals along the way. As mentioned, Ethan Coen is directing this. It is not a Coen Brothers movie. It is just Ethan, written by Ethan and Trisha. What did you guys think of Drive Away Dolls? Did you like it, love it, dislike it, hate it, or it was just okay? Courtney, kick us off.
Well, to revisit the earlier conversation, I looked it up. Apparently, Ethan did have a movie in 2022. It was a documentary called Jerry Lee Lewis, Trouble in Mind.
Ah, so first narrative solo
yes.
directing. Yes. Okay. All right. That makes sense.
As for the movie itself, I'm not going to say this was so bad it's good. It was just good to me. I had a great time with this movie. But I also think that a lot of the mileage you get out of this movie will depend on whether or not you are a lesbian like the main two characters. I think that's going to factor into it, at least a little bit. I loved this movie. I laughed a lot. I enjoyed the fact that this movie was not scared to come in with an under 90-minute runtime. In a world where too many movies blow up to 2.5-3 hours when they don't need to, I respected that this one wheeled in, said what it needed to say, and darted out at what I want to say an hour and 24 minutes, thereabouts.
So I'm going to say that's a loved it. So is that
loved it very much.
All right. Andrew, what about you? Like it, love it, dislike it, hate it, or was just okay?
High side of liked it.
Well, I'm going to be the lowest on this, I think. I think this movie, I'm on the high side of just okay. I will talk about reasons why later, but for now, let's talk about why this movie is so good. Courtney, you liked it the most, so talk a little bit more about the things that you really liked in Driveway Dolls.
I'm not going to harp too much on the identity stuff, because obviously we get a lot of that in the real world. I will just say, we don't get a lot of lesbian movies, one or two a year maybe. So you got to take what you can get. And I feel like this one kind of knocked it out of the park for me. I liked the quirky characters. I liked that you had your typical Coen fingerprints through it with a lot of really wacky people and hijink situations. I felt like our main characters here between Jamie and Marion had a lot of chemistry with each other. I liked the way that their romance slowly unfolded as they came together for a surprisingly tender love story. And this is probably the most out of left field thing, but to me, being a native Arkansan, I kind of saw some Charles Portis elements in the story here. If you've read any stuff like Norwood or Dog of the South, any of his more screwball comedies, this kind of feels like a rated R version of one of those. And I just felt like that really added to the oddballness of this really quirky, hippie-ish kind of time capsule movie.
Yeah. I will say, Courtney, we're not afraid to talk about the identity stuff here at CivPop. And I think it's a big part of the importance of a movie like this is the identity stuff and the ability for so many different segments of our population, our community, to be able to see themselves on screen more. And one of the things I loved about this, and I'll go ahead and take over, the primary thing I really loved about this movie was its sexual frankness. And when I say that, what I mean is Hollywood has sold this idea of sexuality for so long that it's this only this certain type of thing. And I don't just mean heterosexuality versus homosexuality, those kind of things. I mean that it's people who look this way, that's what's sexy, that it's moving this way that is sexy, that it's this kind of candle lighting and this kind of music and, this is what sex is. And this movie is sexually frank in a way that goes, sex is also kind of ridiculous. It's kind of silly. And this movie is frank enough and explicit enough for us to be able to, I think, understand that in a way that very few movies do. Now, the perspective it's coming from, I think, is a big part of that. As well, but I think there needs to be not only more perspectives shown in cinema, but also a wider view of just what being human is about. And so I think this movie does that really, really well. It's probably my favorite part about the movie. Andrew, what are some of the things you liked about Driveway Dolls?
I think that Margaret and Geraldine are sensational together. The odd couple friendship works. Anything beyond the friendship with, I kind of struggle with, I will admit, just because I didn't think that there was a natural progression to the romance part of that relationship.
You mean anything beyond their friendship together, so their romantic interest you struggled with?
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay,
yeah,
okay.
The movie starts off with them being friends, and I guess maybe it was just too quick or too rash for especially the Geraldine's character to loosen up enough, I guess you could say, to let her freak flag fly, I guess is what you could call it.
I don't know. I never feel like the character, I mean, I'm trying not to get too much into spoilers, but I don't feel like the personality of that character changes. I feel like they just find an openness to their existing self. I don't think they, like you say, let your freak flag fly. I don't think the character ever really does that. I don't think that's them. And I think the movie is making a point in some ways about, again, the difference between, and how people interact and have relationships.
I think most of the character evolution comes from Jamie rather than it does Marion, because you start off this movie on this road trip where Jamie is clearly just out to get Marion laid. You know, she just wants her to, she admits, haven't had sex in 3 years. Jamie goes, great, we're going to hit some bars. We're going to find you someone to be with. One night stand. Boom, boom, boom. And I feel like Jamie comes to slowly realize over the course of this road trip that Marion's just not a one night stand kind of person. So if she's going to be with somebody, it needs to be with someone she trusts. It needs to be someone that she's careful and considerate with, and someone who's going to really take care of her. And Jamie realizes there's really only one person in the world that's going to be, it's going to be me. So let's do it. And the fact that Marion is open to that, I think, kind of shows that most of the character evolution takes place with Jamie, our resident Texan.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, and I think there's a message painted on the trunk of the car that I think serves as that character change. I think that is a literal interpretation of the character development of that character from what's written on the trunk at the beginning to what we see written on the trunk at the end. And I think that's what the movie is saying, and kind of like it. So what else do you guys want to talk about before I tell you why I didn't like this movie as much as you guys did?
Oh, I have cons, but I think this film, we haven't mentioned, is very funny. I think that the quick dialogue mixed with Southern accents and social awkwardness is just a winning combination for hilarity to ensue. It's really quick dialogue, something that you can expect from Coen brothers, not like quite Aaron Sorkin quick dialogue, mm-hmm. but the the tit for tat going back and forth, especially with Margaret's character. So funny. I thoroughly enjoyed, like, from beginning to end, I really enjoyed the comedy in this one.
I will jump on your point to say Beanie Feldstein is amazing in this movie and is I think the only person who works the dialogue the way it's supposed to be worked. I didn't think anybody else nailed it like she did. And that was one of my problems with this movie is I felt the manufacturedness of the dialogue a lot with the other characters. It felt like they were trying to say the script and not necessarily something that was coming from them. When Beanie Feldstein was on screen, I was like, oh no, that's that character. Like, it's coming from inside of her, you know? And I just didn't have that experience with everybody else. So I guess it's kind of a pro and con for me, because I hear what you're saying, but I really kind of only experienced it with the Beanie Feldstein character.
That's unfortunate, because I felt it with many people.
Great. I wish I had, for sure.
Yeah. You want to talk about false marketing sort of transitioning from the previous thing. I remember watching the trailer and seeing, oh, Pedro Pascal is in this movie. I like Pedro Pascal. Then he is in this even less than Henry Cavill is in Argyle.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Pedro Pascal is not really in this movie. It is a cameo. It's a cameo. It's a straight cameo.
But every single time I saw him, I went head over heels.
Yes, you did. I see what you did there. What else can we talk about? I guess I could say the other part of the dialogue, I don't know if it's because I know that Ethan did this without Joel, but I feel like there's just part of the spark missing with the tone of this movie. It feels a little more slapdash than I'm used to Coen stuff feeling. Coen stuff has always felt quirky to me. It's always felt interesting. It's always been a little bit different and a little bit elevated, like an elevated reality. But the transitions in this, like, they felt like I could have done them, 20 years ago. I could have done them when this movie came out on my computer. There's this weird interlude stuff that I know what it is. Like, I know what the movie is saying that is. Like, we eventually get to understanding what that interlude is about.
The payoff isn't worth it.
But it's not. It's not. And it's just I feel like a lot of this movie is Ethan trying to figure out what it means for him to direct a movie. And it feels a little clunky and chopped together for me, which impacts the ability of the tone to land for me. So the tone wasn't always landing for me because of that perceived clunkiness on my part. So
when it comes to the editing, I kind of go down the middle of the road a little bit. I see what you're saying, how some of the effects, especially with, the tie-dye transitions and whatnot, I definitely felt like those went on a little too long. But at the same time, anytime you had like the crack of the whip or like the tumble of the camera, I felt like that just added more of a unique identity to the movie because you don't see a lot of those transitions, a lot of those edits used in modern cinema. But for this movie to be such a throwback to like an exploitation kind of film that you would be used to seeing 10, 20, 30 years ago, I feel like those transitions just fold in to the late 90s-ness of this movie with the Rolodexes and the payphones and whipping out the Atlas to chart your path with a marker down the interstate, things like that. I think it all folds together into the time capsuleness of this movie, and the editing, to me, just sinks into that nicely.
I think there's a possibility that you mentioned how quick this movie is in and out, like 120 or whatever, 124, I think is what you said. I think there's a possibility Ethan assembled a cut and it was like an hour long. And he was like, how do we make these, and then all that tie-dye stuff was added just to, space out the transitions to get to feature length. Like, that's kind of how it feels to me at times. That is probably wrong.
Oh, it was probably in the script. Film.
But that's what it feels like, for me.
I could see a little bit of that. When I remember looking at the casting list after I'd watched the movie and I went, Miley Cyrus was in this? What did you? Oh, so yeah, definitely you get some of those moments where these just very trippy transitional tie-dye scenes, they just make up a little too much of the movie for me.
Yeah.
No, yeah, the audience is sitting there wondering like, okay, yeah, we've seen these transitions before. It's going on way too long. Get back to the movie.
Yeah, I was feeling that way. I can tell you there were members of the audience that I saw this with that were feeling a certain way because they left. There were three walkouts on this movie. I haven't experienced that in a long time. Of course, we live in the buckle of the Bible Belt, and I don't think it was the homosexuality. I think it was the explicit sexuality. I think, this movie starts off literally with a bang. Like, this is, is a movie that is going to let you know right away, what kind of movie it is. And I think for those people, they're like, yeah, I didn't sign up for this. And so they left. Yeah.
The Coens aren't known for doing raunchy comedies. So
no. And I wonder if that's maybe more of Ethan's personality. Maybe that was something he wanted to get more into the rated R aspect of things. What were you going to say, Courtney?
Well, I don't know exactly where you would cut the credit for the film right down to the percentage points. But one thing I think we have to keep in mind with this movie is Ethan definitely directed the movie, but he co-wrote it with his wife, Trisha Cook, who also edited. And she injected a lot of the lesbian identity into this movie. So when you're seeing all of the things that I loved, the commentary on lesbian hookup culture, the commentary on what it's like to be gay in America before the Supreme Court had said, yeah, you guys can go ahead and get married. What gay bars were like. I was blown away by the fact that this movie set in what, 99 or just a couple years after that.
91. And
was no, it 91?
No. They were talking about Y2K. It was
99.
Yeah. It was late 90s. The end of the Clinton years is what they were talking about.
So I don't think Bush had been elected yet.
But
every little podunk town they hit somehow had a lesbian bar. And you fast forward to today, and there are maybe 5 or 6 lesbian bars left in the entire United States, which again gets back to Trisha Cook sort of injecting her experience as a gay woman into this movie. And so a lot of this, you know, does this feel like Ethan Coen? Is this Ethan Coen directing by himself? It's kind of hard to figure out what's him, what's his wife, how did it come together, and how exactly does it make this little bit of an uneven tone that we've been talking about?
Yeah, I haven't done a lot of research on their relationship either, but they have a very non-traditional relationship, the two of them. I think they've been married over 30 years, and it's something I think that is interesting to look at, and in its regards to how it impacts like this movie, I think you're right. I think Trisha probably has a lot to say here that Ethan is putting on the screen for her in many ways. So I definitely hear what you're saying and agree. Go ahead.
Sorry, just one more point real quick.
Yeah.
When I got home and I was sort of talking to my wife about the movie, I was like, yeah, it had this and this, and then, you know, these commentary was really interesting. This movie wouldn't have gotten made without Ethan Coen's name on it, which is kind of a commentary on the state of Hollywood. You talk about not a lot of movies made from the perspective of, you know, not just mother-daughter elements, but superhero mother-daughter elements. The fact that Ethan Coen was the name on this, and the fact that this movie wouldn't have gotten made without his name on it, I think kind of speaks to the current state of where we are with getting movies like this made in the first place. And I guess that it's good that this movie got made to me, but it's also a little frustrating that you're not going to see Hollywood making experimental movies like this without these guaranteed.
I don't think you're going to see Hollywood making experimental movies at all, which is unfortunate. Like, I just think they're really going to buckle down and do what they think can make, you know, them the most money. But then again, you know, something will break out and it's just like, how did that make $500 million? And so, you know, we'll see. The landscape is changing so much. It's going to be really interesting to see what movies get made over the next few years, as we kind of figure out what the new normal is. Any final thoughts? One last thing about Driveway Dolls.
No post-credit scene.
I will say, and this is a very fringe connection, my favorite movie of all time, and you know this if you follow me on Twitter, is Twister. I love Twister. Been to the Twister Museum. Mm-hmm. And Joey Slotnick was in this movie, and I didn't realize it was him and that he played one of the storm chasers for Bill and Joe until I went again and looked at the cast list, and I went, hang on a minute, that was the guy from Twister.
You look so much like Paul Giamatti, it's not even funny.
Are we talking about Curly? I mean, I don't know him well enough to call him that, but
he's one of the thugs.
Sensitivity guy.
Yeah. There you go. All right, so that's our review of Twisters, which we got an early screening of, and we're able to see. No, it is not that. It is Driveaway Dolls. You can check that out at your local theater. We had various opinions on it, but I think we all thought that we're glad it got made and is worth a watch. So Driveaway Dolls is the name of the movie. All right, before we head on to the best ever challenge today, a reminder that you can support what goes on here at SiftPop at Patreon, patreon.com/SiftPop. Thank you so much for doing that. We appreciate that. We record a little show every time we can to give to our members, so they have a little bit bonus content. Again, you can check that out, everything about it, at Patreon. Patreon.com/SiftPop is where you would go to do that. And thank you. Really appreciate it. Keeps us going. Keeps the website going. All right, let's get into this best ever challenge. Best ever Dakota Johnson movies. She's been in some good movies despite Madam Web. So not a ton of movies, so I imagine there'll be a lot of crossover here. And if there is crossover, of course,
Trump!
You can trump it if you have it higher, so that we'll talk about it at its highest ranking. We'll go number five to number one, and Andrew's going to kick us off. What is your number five Dakota Johnson movie? Movie that Dakota Johnson has been in.
Black Mass.
Yeah. Starring
Johnny Depp.
This I had that in my honorable mentions. Good.
But I've only seen five Dakota Johnson movies, it turns out, and this is one of them. I will say this, Johnny Depp is great in this movie. The movie itself is not good, but he is transformed, and he is truly terrifying as Whitey Bulger.
Yeah, yeah. This movie's not great. I don't think it's terrible, but it's not great. let's go to Courtney. What do you got at number five?
I, too, have only seen five Dakota Johnson movies.
Oh, fun times.
You will be surprised to see that my number five was Madame Web.
Oh!
So
what'd you think?
Shocker, I had a bit of fun with this movie. It wasn't good, but again, I felt like she did the best she could. And that's saying something when you got a movie like Madame Web.
There you go. I'm sorry. I will describe some things for those just listening to the audio, but the Madame Web poster is up. And as Andrew mentioned, all the girls in like have their superhero counterparts in the poster, right? Like in the little mirror shards in the poster. Mm-hmm. And they're just not that much a part of the movie. Also, there's a cutout of the Statue of Liberty in the New York skyline in the M and the W, as if New York City is a huge part of this movie somehow. Like, I'm sorry. It was just noticing.
Get him, Aaron. Get him.
Some weird stuff there. Anyways, Courtney's number five is Madame Web. My number five, I don't remember Dakota Johnson being in, but Letterboxd told me she was, so I'm counting it. I'm going with 21 Jump Street at number
Trump.
Five. Trump! All right, on to our number fours. Andrew, what do you got at number four?
This is where I have the Peanut Butter Falcon.
Trump! Courtney, what do you got at number four?
I have 21 Jump Street.
Trump.
Trump! All right. My number four is The Lost Daughter. I think this movie is great. This movie just came and went. It's Olivia Colman. It's about a seaside vacation that goes terribly, terribly awry in a variety of ways. I think the human elements to this are really interesting. And Dakota Johnson is great in this movie. I love her character in this movie. I think this one is really well directed, really well acted. And if you didn't get a chance to see it when it came out, let me just give it a shout out. The Lost Daughter is good. It is my number four. All right, so I think that moves us on to number threes. Is that correct, Andrew? What is your number three Dakota Johnson film?
This is where I have 21 Jump Street.
All right, let's talk about it. 3, 4, and 5. We have it down the line.
I have no idea where Dakota Johnson is in this movie. No idea. Like, not a clue. I remember Brie Larson. I remember Jonah Hill, and I remember Channing Tatum.
Pretty sure she kisses Channing Tatum.
Really? Wow. I'm going to have
to. Yeah, I just don't remember it. When I saw this movie, I don't think I was like Dakota Johnson aware, probably. So, you know.
That may be it. But I will say this movie is absolutely hilarious. I think that it's just perfect chemistry between Jonah Hill and Channing Tatum. I had no expectations for this movie when it was coming out. I'm like, what, the remake and the Johnny Depp TV show? Okay, sure. And it blew me away. Absolutely hilarious. Really good movie.
Yeah, we all lament the sequels that never got made after 22. would have loved to have seen them all.
All yep. 59 of them.
I had this movie at number five. I think it's hilarious. Courtney, you had it at number four. Do you have any further thoughts?
I mean, yeah, what else can be said? Dakota Johnson's role is very minor. It was very blip and you miss it, I'm pretty sure. But yeah, it's hilarious. Great chemistry between the two. Even the trailer, just the trailer by itself is almost a really good movie just by how funny it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Courtney, that brings us to your number three.
I have Bad Times at the El Royale.
Trump!
All right. My number three has been mentioned. My number three is The Peanut Butter Falcon. Nice. I think this movie is really sweet and really fun. Well acted and you know, tugs on the heartstrings, I think, in all the right ways. So yeah, if you haven't seen The Peanut Butter Falcon, highly recommend it. Some great stuff going on in this movie. So, Andrew, you had it at number four. Is that right?
Yes. Very endearing movie. Just like you said, tugs at the heartstrings, and it's unlike anything you're going to see. It's very original film, beautiful story. You want nothing but good things for everybody in the film.
Yep. That is The Peanut Butter Falcon. All right, on to our number twos. Andrew, what is your number two?
Get the Trump button ready. The Social Network.
Trump! All right, what is your number two, Courtney?
I also have The Social Network.
See, we didn't need to trumpet. We all have The Social Network at number two.
Okay.
Well, there you go. Andrew, talk about it.
Wow, I was really not expecting this. I was expecting somebody to have it at number one. Yeah, it's not based on reality. It's based on a book, so just keep that in mind going in. But, man, what a fascinating performance by Jesse Eisenberg. And Aaron Sorkin just knows how to write quippy dialogue, and I think that that's the perfect combination. I think Jesse Eisenberg knows how to deliver Aaron Sorkin dialogue better than anyone besides maybe Jeff Daniels.
I think Eisenberg is great in this, but I think Garfield and Timberlake make this movie in many ways. Mm. Their characters, I think of the Eisenberg character as almost the middle of those two characters in a tug of war, and it's a really interesting dynamic and done really, really well. So yeah, love The Social Network. Courtney, some thoughts?
I think that I definitely remember, like you said, Timberlake's performance as a real standout here. And it's through his role that you get to Dakota Johnson's small little role here. I think that the scene that they share together is funny. I think that they have a good chemistry for that little scene, the little bit there together. I also, and this is a conspiracy theory, I think that The Social Network is a prequel to Now You See Me.
Mm. I think you're wrong.
I think after Jesse Eisenberg kind of lost it with the, you know, going crazy with power over inventing Facebook, I think he turned to magic and decided he wanted to go steal a lot of stuff.
Mm. And so it's all a prequel to Lex Luthor, I think.
Yeah.
So it all ends up there. There you go. That is The Social Network, which means we had it all at number two. So we're on to our number ones. Andrew, kick off your number one with
Bad Times at the El Royale.
Me too.
It's crazy because I came here before the show expecting to have to defend why this movie was going to be my number one. And now I'm flabbergasted and I have no really reason to talk about the movie. But no, I think that if you were to put Social Network and Bad Times in front of me right now, I think I would rather watch Bad Times at the El Royale. I think that the tension, the mystery of it all is very fascinating. And I love the dichotomy between it's California and
Nevada.
Nevada, thank you. So you have this, the whole movie is based around making choices, one choice or another. And it's just such a great, great dynamic you have. And then all the performances are really good as well.
Phenomenal performances. In many ways, I think most of this cast, it's one of their best, if not best, performances in their careers. I love Hemsworth in this. I love, yeah. love Lewis Pullman in this.
He's so good.
Love John Hamm in this.
You didn't at first.
until I knew what he was doing. So by the end of the movie, I'm like, oh, that's genius. And beyond that, I think it's one of the most intelligently structured and themed movies I've ever seen. The way this movie plays with choices and dichotomies and the line down the middle and which side are you on, what is good, what is bad, what is white, what is black, what is, immoral, what is moral, how does a coin flip land, all of that stuff is so intricately woven into a story that just works. It's tense, it's interesting, the structure works. This is one of my favorite movies of all time. I just think Bad Times is great. So yeah,
I especially love Jeff Bridges as the priest. Oh wait, mm-hmm. maybe not.
Mm-hmm.
This is also, I want to say, the most Quentin Tarantino non-Tarantino movie I have ever seen in my life.
It's so up there.
I had to keep looking at it, going, "This isn't a Tarantino movie. Are you sure?"
Until Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, though. Tarantino can't make this movie. There's too much heart in this movie. Tarantino didn't know how to, in my opinion, put this kind of heart in a film. He knew how to do the needle drops and crafting the tension and those kind of stuff. But this movie has heart that I don't think a Tarantino movie had until Once Upon a Time.
And a lot of that heart comes from Cynthia Erivo, or Arrivo. I don't know how to say her last name. Sorry.
It's Erivo, but...
Erivo, yeah. A lot of the heart comes from her, and the scene where Dakota Johnson is behind the two-way mirror holding the shotgun, and she's just singing and smacking her foot on the ground and clapping. Ah, that's how you do tension right there, ladies and gentlemen. That's how you do tension right there.
And this movie is so good at its reveals. Everything it reveals, it reveals at the perfect time for the audience. I want to see Drew Goddard do more of this stuff. I really do. I think he's really smart and crafts some really interesting stories. So,
When you talk about, like, most of the time when you ask somebody, what was your favorite part of the movie or what do you remember the most? Most people aren't going to say the editing. This is a very sharply edited movie. This is, you walk out of it and you go, yeah, that was put together really well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Was it your number one too, Courtney?
No, my number one was Cha-Cha Real Smooth.
It's a good one.
I have a very soft spot for Apple TV Plus's dramas. I loved Coda. I was thrilled when that won the Oscar for Best Animated Picture. I love Cha-Cha Real Smooth. They had... What was the other drama about the two brothers who their father died and they had to go bury him with Ethan Hawke and Ian McGregor. It's not coming to my mind, but that's another Apple TV Plus drama film. And I felt like Dakota Johnson was great in this. You talk about heart. I mean, the amount of heart that she displays as not just a mother in here, but a mother who's raising a daughter who has special needs and trying to figure out what her marriage looks like going forward, trying to navigate the complicated feelings she has for this newcomer whose job is dancing at bar mitzvahs and getting the party started. Everything that could go right with this movie went right for me. And Dakota Johnson is a very, very big part of that. I love her whole emotional appeal in this movie.
It was definitely in my honorable mentions. I like Cha-Cha. I think it's a really fun, interesting movie, good perspective, and I really enjoyed watching it. That is Cha-Cha Real Smooth at number one. You guys said you'd only seen five Dakota Johnson. None of you saw any of the 50 Shades movies?
Nope.
Just a little too hetero for my tastes.
Fair enough.
There you go. There's the best ever Dakota Johnson films. All right, let's finish up with some buried treasure, guys. What's that one thing in any area of pop culture that you want to make sure people know about it? Courtney, you're our guest, so you will finish us off. I'm going to go ahead and go first. I'm just going to take the big one. Sorry if I'm stealing it from you, Andrew, but I don't actually remember your relationship to this property, but I have to talk about The Last Airbender on Netflix, which came out yesterday, I think, and I've already watched all 8 episodes because I just love this material. I binged 4 or 5 last night, and then I binged the other, you know, 3 or 4 today. I have lots of thoughts on this, but I will say overall, I'm glad it exists. It's interesting to me to see the story told compressed like this from 20 episodes to 8, although those 20 episodes were much shorter episodes. But they all had to have kind of conclusions to them. And so you're missing a lot of kind of the adventures of the week kind of stuff and really going more for the overall world building and, adventuring they're doing. It changes a couple of the world building dynamics, but not a ton. And that's why I'm kind of mixed feelings on this, because as much as I love seeing these characters who, by the way, not like it was a tough, limbo bar to get under, or over, but the characters here match the characters so much better than the M. Night adaptation. Sokka in this is finally like funny and gregarious and a dork and like, you know, like he has to find his cool, which is what one of the things I loved about the character. Aang, and yes, it's Aang, not Ong, as apparently it was in the M. Night movie. That
you keep referencing a movie. I don't know what movie you're talking about.
No, you're right. It doesn't exist. That was a fever dream I had one time. But he's a kid here and he's having fun, and it just feels like the Aang from the cartoon series. Everybody seems to work. Right down to Aang's childhood friend Bumi. It just every character they bring on screen feels like a perfect live representation of those characters. My double mind is there's always that part of me that's like, but did I need to see the same story again? And I guess like at the end of the day, yeah, when it's this property, I'll see it told as many times as you want. Like I really like this world. I think the structure of these characters and what they go through and, you know, we're dealing of course a lot with Zuko's transition from, you know, evil to compassion. A lot of that happens in season one and is one of the primary things we're going through here. The Uncle Iroh stuff is really beautiful here. There's references that are fun and interesting. We get a secret tunnel. We get the song Secret Tunnel. We get little wafts of Leaves on the Ground when Uncle Iroh is talking to Zuko about different meaningful things, and you kind of hear his song that if you've watched the animated series, you know, you're probably already crying because it's just that beautiful and that wonderful. And so to have it in the score when those conversations are happening was a really smart manipulation that they do. I had a really, really fun time watching it. And then on the occasional moment of, yeah, but it's just the same. I'm not learning anything new. And so I'm kind of like, okay, excited to see if we do all 3 seasons, and I hope we do. And then I'm excited to see, like, do we do Korra? Do we do between, this and Korra? Like, do we go out into the world a little bit more and find some new things? Yeah, and I haven't even touched on how the creators walked out of the project and kind of what they were upset about, mostly because none of that is set in stone. It's just kind of rumors of, where the differences were. But I think it turned out okay. I really think it turned out okay. What are you two's relationship to the material, and are you planning on watching this / have you watched any of it?
I was going to watch, but then the Fire Nation attacked. No, I've never seen. I think I've seen the pilot of the animated, but it is something I've really wanted to, just because it's so heavily praised by everybody who has seen it. They're like, Oh, no, you need to watch Avatar because it is phenomenal. And I'm like, okay, I'll get around to it. And it's just one of those things. So with this live action, is this first season, I know it's only 8 episodes, is it a remake of the first season of the show?
Yes, pretty much. Yes, the through point is the through point of the first season. Yeah.
Okay.
Which so was this movie that didn't exist from famed director M. Night Shyamalan. That was also
just the first season.
Yeah.
I'm so confused. You keep bringing that up.
I have to say I've never seen the M. Night Shyamalan movie.
Good.
And I have no desire because it
doesn't
to.
Exist. Because it doesn't exist. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, so here was my original plan was I was going to stream this tonight starting right around 5 o'clock Central. And this guy emailed me when I was in a coffee shop this afternoon. He said, hey, we've got a podcast. Would you like to fill in? And I said, sure. And so I haven't seen it yet, but now you know why. I would be very excited to see if they do end up following through and they come up to Korra, if they're going to do Korra. Now that the announcement has come out that they are making new animated movies set with the original characters, but in their 20s and 30s, it'll be interesting to see if this live action follows those or if they follow the graphic novels like The Promise. It just, there's so many directions they could go through with this. And this is such a vibrant property. This is such a vibrant property that it seems like everybody walked away from this project, got to do something they wanted to do. Netflix got to keep its live action Avatar project intact, and people seem to like it okay. It kind of like One Piece, everybody seems surprised at the quality and what they were able to accomplish. But at the same time, the original creators, even though they walked out, guess what? They're back at Nickelodeon Studios now, and they're getting to make some more movies with their own perspective on the animated Avatar version. Mm-hmm. So best of both worlds, and how often does that happen with stuff like this?
Yeah. It'll be interesting to continue to see. Andrew, what is your buried treasure?
I love heist movies, guys. I really do. And I was trying to make a list of the best heist movies I've ever, you know, Inception, Heat, all of these movies. But when I was thinking about what is the best bank heist movie, because Inception's in a heist of the mind, so that one didn't count. I'm going to go with Inside Man. I think Inside Man is one of, if not the best bank heist movies. I think that Denzel Washington and Clive Owen are spectacular together in this. Jodie Foster. I found the Jodie Foster's character in the Christopher Plummer, that side story arc, to be so fascinating. And I just really wanted to know more and more as the movie progresses. I think that it is a very bold choice for Spike Lee to make a movie where halfway through the movie, he starts doing interviews with the people from the bank, like after they were held hostage. And he interweaves that like as the movie is progressing. And it's a very bold choice. And I think that it's really smart for him to do it that way. If you've never seen Inside Man and you are a fan of bank heist movies, I know Aaron will back me up on this, that it is a phenomenal film.
It's great. It's a great movie.
I was really hoping you were just going to undercut him there and be like, no, actually, I don't like it.
Inside Man, I know Aaron is too well. Terrible. Worst twist ever. It's phenomenal. It's a really great movie. Really well done. Courtney, what's your buried treasure?
I know that there have been some mixed opinions on Kevin Smith's He-Man reboot, his Masters of the Universe revelation. I loved it. Now that we have part 3 out, Masters of the Universe Revolution, I feel like he's finally gotten his He-Man reboot where it should have been to begin with, where he is just pulling out all the stops. He's bringing in characters from the Courtney Cox live action disaster with Dolph Lundgren that was Masters of the Universe in the 80s. And he is bringing all of these character arcs to a satisfactory, if not conclusion, then advancement. I love what he's done with Tila. I love the crazy amount of voice talent there is in this show. You've got Mark Hamill. You've got Chris Wood. You've got Sarah Michelle Gellar. But by far my favorite part of this new He-Man reboot that is on Netflix right now has been the transition of Evil Lyn to just Lyn. And she's voiced by Lena Headey, who is, of course, Cersei Lannister from Game of Thrones. She has just killed this role and given this character so much heart. I probably go back and rewatch clips of her at least once a month, if not once every other month, because she has done such a great job with this character in this action-packed reboot that is campy and it's fun, but it also has heartfelt moments that really almost make you tear up and ask yourself, wait, this is He-Man, right? Why am I tearing up over He-Man?
And I'm just looking at this cast and it is stacked.
Kevin Smith knew what he was doing. He still does. I hope he gets a part four and continues to know what he is doing.
Well, there you go. That is Masters of the Universe Revolution. Is that what you said? Master of the Universe.
Yes.
On Netflix, I believe is where you can check that out. Inside Man is streaming on Stars. We're available on VOD. And the new Avatar The Last Airbender live action series is 8 episodes on Netflix as well. Well, there you go, guys. We did it. We did a podcast. Ooh. Congratulations to everybody. We didn't even have to see into the future to make it happen. So look at us go. We managed to do it.
This podcast is better than that movie.
Thanks for joining us today for Stiff Pop. It is part of the Studio DNA Podcast Network. You can find out more about other shows in the network at studiodna.media or by searching Studio DNA in your podcast player. Huge thanks to Andrew for hanging out again today.
Oh, thank you, buddy.
Big thanks to producer Phil for producing the audio and video show.
Thanks, Phil.
Thank you to Courtney Lanning for coming by today. Courtney, where do you want people to find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Twitter or whatever it's called now, under Courtney Movies. One word. Come watch all my controversial animation opinions and fun movie takes. Like, Madam Web wasn't that bad after all.
And there you go. Courtney Movies, at Courtney Movies on social media. Always good to have you on. Thanks for coming by. And
thanks for having me.
And skipping the Avatar Watch to be with us today. Much love and gratitude to our SiftPop members as well. That happens at Patreon, patreon.com/SiftPop. Support starts at $3 a month. So you can check that out there. Lots of fun little things go on for our members there. You can have an impact by connecting with us through leaving a comment, a rating, or a review wherever you listen. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever that might be. You can email us, feedback@siftpop.com, if you have any questions. And finally, if you're having a good time, your movie-loving friends will probably like the show too. So let them know about it and that listening is much easier than finding a cameo that Matt Damon would turn down. We will be back next week with more movies and more fun, and we will see you then. Bye.
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 Save big money at Menards. Let the fresh air in and keep the bugs out with replacement screen for your doors and windows from AdForce. It's easy to install, durable against the elements, and comes in a variety of types to suit your needs. Repair your screens today with a roll of replacement screen on sale through May 5th. And check out more great deals happening now in our weekly flyer on Menards.com. Save big money
at Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications at TryLifeMD.com? We're now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
It's fun to put on jeans that you couldn't get into 6 months ago.
Every morning, I look forward to getting on the scale.
For anybody who's struggling with their weight, it's a godsend.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.